evening, you all. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. You'll also be hearing Mel, K2 Kilo Echo Yankee. Mel and Dick attempt to organize, coordinate, otherwise moderate this enthusiastic crew that meets most Sunday evenings to discuss their favorite subject, ham radio, wireless techniques, antennas, propagation, science in general, but most likely the science of concerned with wireless techniques and radio. A person signs into the new improved technical net by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. We call this the new improved technical net because during the first hour, in order to respond to a frequent complaint we've been having for some time, was that the subjects being discussed during the first hour were too long. A person signing in would have to wait a very long period of time before his particular subject came up. So during the first hour, we try to cover everybody briefly, and then for the more deep discussions that take place beyond that first hour is where we really dig into things more deeply. During the first hour, we try to cover as many people's questions as possible, as I said, lightly. Also, we try to cover as many questions as reasonable that Mel gets through his mailbag through the Internet. Those are particularly, let me drop. What Mel gets an awful lot of are questions from people who have found the technical net and LIMARC and 2-meter repeaters and whatever in general by way of their scanner radios or ham radio operators telling them by one means or another they found out what's going on with ham radio and said, gee, I want to join that. And so the younger, newer people are requesting an awful lot of information as to how to find out how the stuff works so that they can pass all the questions for the exam to get the ham radio license, which is essentially cost-free. Oh, there's a small fee of a couple of dollars, but if you compare what happens to a commercial radio two-way license where people have to pay big bucks in many cases and to wait on a long waiting list in order to get one single frequency for two-way radio to maintain their taxi cab or oil delivery service or whatever. We, as ham radio operators, are given a tremendous amount of spectrum. Every octave of the band, a whole lot of megacycles are dedicated to ham radio. So free of charge, you're getting one hell of a resource once you get that ham radio license. Okay, as I said before, a person signs in by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, meaning you do have a question or a comment. A typical sign-in would sign like this, N2EO, Rich and Yes, one of our frequent sign-ins. So give me your call letters and name at this time, K2RIW listening.
Bob and Yes.
Hey, Bob, and also K2GAE. I heard you on the input. I did not hear you through the output. In other words, your PL oscillator at 136.5 hertz is apparently not turned on. So as I said, I'm hearing you on the input, GAE, but not hearing on the output. So far we got GAE, who said yes but didn't give us a name, and Bob. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name at this time. K2RIW.
KC2YDT, yes.
And Mr. Yankee Delta Tango, I think it is YDT, give me your name, sir.
Hey, Dick, it's Matt, KC2YDT.
Yeah, I should know that, Matt. I've heard you on quite often, but I don't know if you and I have had a direct conversation yet. Bob, Matt, and GAE. Anyone else to sign in with the quick questions during the first hour of the new improved technical net? Give me your call letters and name at this time. K2RIW listening.
Good evening. K2KEY.
Yeah, that mysterious voice was Mel. K2GAE. Want to make one more try to see if you've got your PL oscillator turned on so that we hear you through the output of the machine? Give me a call right now with your name, sir.
This 2 Golf Juliet Echo. Handle is Ed.
Okay, Golf Juliet Echo.
K2GJE.
Got you that time, Ed. Okay. You were the first person who signed in. Why don't you give me your question right now? K2 Golf Juliet Echo. K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Thank you, Dick. I was just interested in what power is being dissipated in the termination when you have a non-resident antenna, like a rhombic terminated in a resistor, or a loop terminated in a resistor, or a beverage terminated in a resistor. Are we dissipating power in that termination? Back to net.
Very fine, Ed. And this is a frequent area of misunderstanding among many amateurs. Of all the kinds of antennas that exist in the world, you could, if you want to, break them into two groups. There's many ways you can break them up, but one way, in a very coarse way, you could break them up into standing wave antennas and traveling wave antennas. A dipole, for instance, is a standing wave antenna. That means the energy that your transmitter and transmission line supplies to that dipole, that energy goes onto the wire of the dipole and bounces back and forth something like 20 times before it's radiated. So in other words, you may have a perfect impedance match on your transmission line. It may be a 70-ohm twin lead going to a 70-ohm dipole antenna. And so there's no standing wave ratio on the transmission line, but on the antenna itself, there is a standing wave. And that's the reason why it's called a standing wave structure. In the case of a traveling wave structure, rhombic and beverage, among others, the signal that you put from the transmission line onto the antenna, let me drop. The energy or the signal you put on the antenna travels down the antenna only once. It doesn't bounce back and forth. And the reason you put that terminating resistor on the far end of a rhombic or a beverage antenna is to make sure that the signal travels down there once, and of the signal that gets radiated along that length, and usually beverage and rhombic antennas, you make each of the arms of that antenna usually multiple wavelengths long, giving it lots of opportunity to radiate. And you'd like a high percentage of the signal to radiate, and maybe 75% of it does. Of the 25% that's left over, it hits the termination, gets absorbed, turned into heat. And the first question the average person will ask is, gee, why do I want to do that? Why in the world would I want to waste some of the energy into that termination? Why can't I eliminate that? Why can't I tune it some other way? And so the first thing that you ask is, gee, what will happen if I eliminate that termination? And you can do that with a beverage or a rhombic antenna. And the antenna will work very well, but there's a catch. Of the signal that traveled down the antenna, that got radiated to space in a particular direction, and then ordinarily the remaining energy would be absorbed by that resistor. You eliminate the resistor, the energy doesn't get absorbed, it bounces back. Now it's traveling back on your beverage or your rhombic antenna in the reverse direction, and your front-to-back ratio degrades. So a rhombic or a beverage antenna has a very good front-to-back ratio when the resistor of the termination is there. You can eliminate the termination, and now you have a fairly poor front-to-back ratio because you're radiating in both directions because the signal is traveling down that antenna in both directions. A really smart guy, let me drop. Once a really smart guy understands the theory of operation of these traveling wave antennas, he can arrange to have relays and transmission lines that go to both ends of the antenna. You can decide to feed it from the east toward the west and have a termination at the west, and you're radiating a nice strong signal to the west, and you've got a good front-to-back ratio east to west. Then you flip the relays, and instead of feeding the antenna on the eastern side, you feed the antenna on the western side. And now the signal propagates from west to east and hits the termination, and you've got a strong signal in the other direction. So these traveling wave antennas have a beautiful front-to-back ratio. You can intentionally degrade the front-to-back ratio by eliminating the termination, or you can feed it in the opposite direction and terminate it. The choice is yours once you realize how it works. maybe that helps somewhat at KG2GJE, K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, Ed.
Okay, thank you. I understand as far as getting, you're always getting something for nothing. I always looked at it as a transmission line that was radiating, which I think is what it really is. Okay, now, so we're going to be radiating off the wires, and if the wires, you know, if they're spaced too close together, they're not going to radiate. It's going to make like a pair of open wire lines. And you space them apart so they do radiate, and they're quite far apart if they're a beverage or a rhombic or a loop. And do you mean to say it's possible to dissipate 25% of the power putting in that termination? I imagine we get less at that termination by the longer we could make it. Over.
You've got it exactly right, Ed. In the case of open wire line, 300 ohm, 600 ohm, 450 ohm line, I'm looking for the right page. The latest issue of QST Magazine, the January issue, there it is. It's on page 59. If you take a look at the January issue of QST Magazine, which, by the way, has my antenna on the front cover. When I say my antenna, I mean the antenna that me and George Flanagan, W2KRM, so to speak, invented in 1978, the method of construction where the elements go through the boom with these black shoulder bushings and so on, and the driven element is fed in a particular way. That is on the front cover of the latest issue. And that was a commercial product way back in 1978 by W2KRM, who worked with me, so to speak. Alrighty, so on page 59, you'll find a formula which tells you how much your open wire line radiates. And the bottom line is that if the two wires of the open wire line are a small fraction of a wavelength apart, and if they're fed properly in the so-called differential manner, the amount of radiation from your open wire line is extremely small, probably numbers like minus 50 decibels. In other words, 0.001% gets radiated by the transmission line. And your rhombic antenna, let me drop it. Your rhombic antenna, you could say, is where you've taken the open wire line, and as you enter the area that you call antenna, you separate the wires a significant number of wavelengths, and you make each one of the arms of the rhombic a significant number of wavelengths long. That forces radiation to take place. And the magic of the way you set up a rhombic is that it's a very directional antenna. You aim a rhombic to the east, and you can aim an extremely strong signal to the east, obvious by the fact that VK3ATN, I think it's called, it as were, was one of the first guys who set up rhombic antennas in a great big chunk of property in Australia, and he did moon bounce with that antenna on 432. In other words, he was getting approximately 30 decibels of gain in one particular direction. So he would aim this antenna at his southern horizon, so to speak, and then when the moon on a couple of days per year was in the right position for about a couple of hours in the main beam of his rhombic antenna, he was doing some beautiful moon bounce with nothing but a simple piece of wire held up by some trees or some poles, many wavelengths long, and it gave him an awful lot of gain. And again, he wanted the front-to-back ratio. He used the termination to make sure that the back lobe looking at Earth wasn't giving him extra noise in his receiver. So I think you see the principle of operation. You now know a little bit more about a traveling wave antenna. And in the case of a beverage, a very simple piece of wire run parallel to the ground, a significant number of feet above the ground, and you could be stringing it through trees, can give you a lot of directivity in one direction with very little cost. And depending on how you terminate it, you either do or don't get a good front-to-back ratio. So it's amazing sometimes how very simple antennas can have extremely high performance. As you do further experiments with those, Ed, please come back and tell us what you found and how well...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
As I said, please come back, tell us what you found and how well it worked out for you. Let me give need to add, all guys, one other caveat, and that is, I've got a fancy way of talking sometimes that make people think that I feel like I'm an expert in a whole lot of areas. That's not necessarily true. I make some pretty big errors. The TechNet is a kind of peer-reviewed journal. By that I mean, you've got this beautiful guy named Mike Perry, KC2NJI, who's put forth tremendous numbers of hours of time recording all of the TechNets, and you can play back those recordings by going to the website amateurradio.tangovictor. So by way of those recordings, by way of people listening to the TechNet, as me, Mel, and other people who sign in occasionally make errors, people will come back to us in a hurry and say, hey, you said such and such, it's really so and so. Well, I've listened to those tapes and you made an error here. So the errors that we make eventually get peer reviewed, we admit the errors, and it gets more corrected. So be a little bit careful about the stuff you hear for the first time, and wait a little bit until the dust has settled and the peer review has taken place, if you really want infinite accuracy, so to speak. The next person who signed in was Bob, AC2 Alpha Zulu. I finally know who you are, Bob, and I hope you've had some clear skies to do some of your serious astronomy telescope work these days. What would you like to talk about? AC2AZ, K2RIW on the TechNet. You got it, Bob.
Dick, one more thing about rhombic.
Yeah, go right ahead, Mel. Stand by a second there, Bob. And I bet you built some rhombics in your day, or at least the guys from the Kings County Radio Club. Go right ahead, Mel.
Of course, the dream of having the property to do it, so that's another story. But one more thing. Just mention one more thing about a rhombic, about the so-called tilt angle, which I was I had seen, which quite impressive by a person I visited Texas at the time when I was stationed for a while in Houston with the company I was with, and he demonstrated the tilt angle of a rhombic. You want to say a few words about that? Over.
Now, I'm not positive, but I'm going to pass it back to you in a minute for confirmation. I think you're talking about the angle of takeoff. In other words, the signal coming out of the rhombic. If I set up a rhombic where I'm feeding it on the west-hand side, and I'm aiming it toward the east, and the termination is on the east, and I want to aim a nice strong signal on the great circle path down to Africa, so to speak, I could be doing that. And depending on how long each of the arms are, how big the rhombic is, and how many feet it is above the ground, determines at what elevation angle the signal comes off that rhombic. So depending on how far away the guy is that I want to talk to, what's the state of the ionosphere today, there is some ideal takeoff angle. In most cases, you'd like the takeoff angle to be as close to the horizon as possible. Lower takeoff angle on your radiation main lobe is usually good for long-distance DX. Gives you the greatest DX, takes the minimum number of bounces off the ionosphere to get from here to there, for the signal to get from here to there. I think that's what you're referring to, and I think the altitude off the ground and the length of the arms are some of the variables that affect the so-called takeoff angle, and maybe that's what you're referring to as tilt angle. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yes, the rhombic aficionados refer to it as the tilt angle of the rhombic, and the reason for that really is, like you say, I've actually seen one. Oh, it was quite an impressive piece of layout with motor controls, winch controls, to actually change the diamond and tilt the diamond for optimum angle in a certain direction. And that's how it really was if you're going to do some serious work with it, that being able to control that so-called tilt angle, which is not much, really. I didn't think that slight tilting of it would give such an effect, but it's amazing that I don't think it's more than maybe a 5-degree tilt that does, a tremendous amount of effect on the rhombic stick. Over.
If my takeoff angle was something like 60 degrees up in the air, and I decreased it from 60 to 55, I'd make a rather minor difference in how strong the signal is when it goes from here to, let's say, the United Kingdom. If my antenna is something like giving a main angle of takeoff, the elevation angle of 8 degrees off the ground, and I tilt it from 8 down to 3, as you get closer and closer to 0 degrees, tremendous improvement can take place. The radio central antennas that were out in Rocky Point on that huge piece of property owned by RCA, and that's where a number of clubs will from time to time hold their field day operations out there. It's now still a great big chunk of land that's not built up. In its heyday, they had rhombic antennas aimed in various directions, and those rhombic antennas were on tops of telephone poles, where the telephone poles were stacked on top of each other. The tops of these wooden telephone poles were close to 200 feet in the air, and the wire was strung across those, and whether or not they had halyards by which they could raise and lower those rhombic antennas, I'm not sure, but I know that when it comes to the press wireless or other kinds of communication that took place between the United States and Europe, those antennas were extremely effective in use for a number of decades and worked like a charm. The actual wire that constituted those rhombic antennas was a kind of a bronze stranded wire. Let me drop. And when that was all taken down, that wire got auctioned off. I've got a piece of that wire, of that bronze antenna wire. And whether or not I was going to use it for a dipole antenna or a guy wire, I'm not sure. But I've got a little piece of that history. But it was kind of amazing that you could stack telephone poles on top of each other and connect them together with wooden structures. And that's what was done out there. So altitude above the ground of the rhombic and whether or not the rhombic itself is tilted gives you some control. And I'm not sure if there's a very big section on rhombic antennas in the ARRL antenna book, but that's one of the first places I would look to find out about rhombics. The nice thing about a rhombic is if you're not counting the cost required for the support structures, which may be on your property, could simply be the trees if you've got a good piece of property. The actual materials that go into the antenna is a simple piece of wire and a terminating resistor at the end and open wire line to feed it. So you're not talking about expensive materials, and yet you're talking about an antenna that can have tremendous performance in decibels of gain. So you get a lot of bang for the dollar out of a rhombic. Not many people understand it, but it's worth considering. Bob, what would you like to talk about tonight? AC2AZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hi, Dick. Good evening to all. First of all, I just want to let you know astronomy is relegated to those out-of-town trips to do those astronomy conventions, and that's about it. But the next one's in Key West in February, so looking forward to that. Wanted to comment on, I don't know if you remember, all that big antenna farm, antenna array in Hopog and in the industrial park. If you remember, you know what that stuff was all about. I always assumed those were for aircraft over the Atlantic for the HF radios that they use to stay in contact. I was wondering if you knew anything about that. And secondly, finally got my Tentec Titan 425 1.5 kilowatt amplifier working, Yahoo. Wanted to know if you could just give me a quick understanding of the tune and the load does on the amplifier. Still playing with it, know how to do it, just trying to understand what it does. Back to you, Dick, AC2AZ.
Very fine, Bob. Up until 1985, McKay Radio was the name of the organization that was located in Hopog on, I'm going to make a guess, 15 acres of property. And what it consisted of was six towers of Rhone 45 type tower. That's 43 inches on a side tower, 100 foot high, six of them in a circle. Each one of them could be lowered by a winch mechanism that would tilt them over. On the top of each one of the six towers was a very large log periodic antenna where the boom length was something like, the boom length was something like 90 feet long. And those antennas operated from something like 6 to 30 or 6 to 40 megacycles. And so those those antennas had a great big rotator on each one of the six towers, on each one of the log periodics, and they could be rotated in any direction that you wanted by a multi-horsepower motor. The actual antenna itself was designed by Collins Radio, and I forget the name of the company that built the actual antenna itself. Those Rhone 45 towers that were at McKay Radio, the majority of them are now in my backyard. When I found out, that that structure, that whole facility was being taken apart, and that they were just going to crunch up those towers with a bulldozer and cart it away as scrap, to me, Rhone 45 is a very valuable kind of tower, and they were in rather good shape. The first one that they tried breaking up with the bulldozer, it broke the blade on the front of the bulldozer. I walked over to the guy who was doing that work, and I said, "You don't want to break up your bulldozer, just to wait about a week. I will slowly take these things apart," because those towers were made for export service. That means the Anaco Rhone company had designed those towers in such a way you could take apart all the nuts and bolts on the crisscross arms, and you ended up with 20-foot tower sections that were nothing but vertical pieces of pipe, 2.5 inches in diameter, Schedule 80 steel pipe, galvanized, with these crisscross arms. You could take them all apart and cart away the pieces, and that's what I did. So of those six towers, I guess about three or four of them were still left, and they ended up in my backyard. I also had collected one of those log periodic antennas, took it all apart, and had all the parts sitting in a nice, neat pile as I left at dark one night. I was going to come back the next morning and pick them up. Well, the scavengers came along in the middle of the night, saw that as a pile of aluminum, which has a certain scrap value, and they cut it up into small pieces, put it on their trucks, and carted it away. There was nothing for me to remove the next morning. I saw the truck with the pieces of parts inside, and I talked to the guy saying, "Didn't you realize that somebody put them into a nice, neat pile, that they were really about to use them for some other service?" And the guy said he didn't know. I think he really knew. Let me drop. So McKay Radio was doing a kind of press wireless service. They were doing communication primarily for newspapers, among other things, between the United States and Europe, and among other places in the world. And that was a very active service up until 1985, when satellites started taking over that service, satellites and undersea cables. The guy who is the expert on the subject now as to the complete history of McKay Radio in Hop Hog is George Flanagan, W2KRM, Whiskey 2 Kilowatt Radio Mike. He has on two or three occasions given talks at Radio Central and also at Ham Radio University, in which he shows the hundreds of photographs he has collected of that facility, as well as the RCA facility out in Rocky Point. He is, radio-wise, the best historian we've got on the on Long Island, where all of the older spark gap, arc gap, and whatever radio sets that were in use at that time in the very early days, and these two facilities in Rocky Point and Hop Hog in the later days, he has collected all those photographs, he knows the names of the people, and he gives these talks where, if you want to see the history of early radio, and you know that George W2KRM is about to give a talk, I recommend you go and visit that particular talk, because I think you'll enjoy it. I've seen two of his talks. By my standards, they're very well done. Now, one last question, that is on the tuning and loading. Let me drop. Back in the days when our transmitters, like a DX100 or a Collins transmitter, had tubes in the final, 90-some-odd% of all of those rigs used a PI network in the final tuning tank circuit. In other words, to resonate the tube, to properly impedance match the power coming out of the tube, to go from the tube impedance, which in many cases is 1,500 ohms, and your antenna impedance, which in many cases is 50 ohms, in between that two, you have a PI network. The PI network is called that because when you draw the schematic diagram of it, it looks like the Greek letter PI. You've got a vertical capacitor called C1 on the left side. Across the two capacitors, horizontally, you've got an inductor, and another vertical capacitor on the right-hand side called C2. C1, the left-hand capacitor, the one closest to the tube, is usually called the tuning capacitor. The right-hand capacitor on that Pi network is called the loading capacitor. Study the way that network works. It really is a kind of voltage divider network. If you redraw it correctly, you'll find out that those two capacitors are in series with each other, even though they both have a leg going to ground. It's a voltage divider network where the tube feeds the top of the voltage divider network and the center of the voltage divider network is feeding your antenna. As you adjust C1, the first capacitor, 95% of what it does is adjust the tuning. That is to say, the frequency of resonance goes up and down as you move C1. As you move C2, the bigger capacitor, you're adjusting the loading. You can go from a 30-ohm to a 50-ohm to a 70-ohm antenna by adjusting the value of that capacitor. And 95% of what the tuning load, the C2 capacitor, the loading capacitor does, is to adjust loading. But there's a catch. Let me drop. As you really study the mathematics of a Pi impedance matching network or tank circuit, there is interaction. When you adjust the first capacitor, you're adjusting the tuning, and 95% of what you're doing is tuning adjustment, but it has a little bit of bleed through into changing the loading control, loading characteristic. And simultaneously, when you adjust the loading capacitor, 90% or 95% of what you're doing is adjusting the loading, but it does have a little effect on the tuning. So therefore, you usually have to rock back and forth between the two because there is some interaction. And adjusting loading, what that really means is that as you adjust that capacitor, you're doing a better impedance match for, as I said, a 30, a 50, or a 90-ohm resistor, if your antenna was that impedance. It is simultaneously compensating for reactance of the antenna. The nice thing about a Pi network is that the good ones that were on, for instance, the DX100 Heathkit transmitter of the early days, it probably could tolerate most phase angles of an 8-to-1 standing wave ratio, maybe even a 10-to-1, whether it be reactive, resistive, whatever, an 8-to-1 standing wave ratio. The tuning and loading controls on that Pi network had enough range that no matter where you are on the Smith chart within the 10-to-1 standing wave ratio circle, so to speak, you could bring the impedance right back to the center of the chart by adjusting those controls. They had nice, big tuning range, and you could tolerate a lot of mismatch, and your antenna at certain phase angles, the network could even tolerate as high as a 20-to-1 standing wave ratio. You had lots of adaptability. That's the good news. But the Pi network, built correctly with good-sized capacitors, is an inductor, is a fairly voluminous thing. We all wanted these so-called no-tuned capacitors, the nice no-tuned transmitters with nice compact rigs. Let me drop. And so this great big variable tuning network was eliminated. And our modern-day solid-state rigs follow that philosophy. The good news is that the rig is more compact and you don't have to tune it. The bad news is now you're forced in some other means to make sure the antenna has got something like a 1.5 standing wave ratio or better. Otherwise, the rig goes into a self-protect mode of either stopping its transmission or going to a lower power output to protect the final tube. And now you add this other network after it called the antenna tuner. Well, the antenna tuner is the Pi network you used to have. You're taking it away, and now you're putting it back, if you know what I mean. It's a crazy setup. And so have we really come out ahead? I don't know. But the Pi network or the antenna tuner, whichever one you decide to use, whether it's inside the rig or outside the rig, they do the exact same thing, and they are, if built correctly, a lossless network. No matter what the power ratio or voltage ratio is of the signal reflected from your antenna that comes back into the shack, you properly adjust that Pi network, and 98% of that energy gets re-reflected forward in phase with the power coming out of your transmitter right now, and the antenna gets another chance of radiating that signal. These are lossless networks. You'd be amazed how many people think that a Pi network or an antenna tuner takes the reflected power and throws it away. No way. It doesn't do that. Maybe that helps a little bit, Bob. AC2AZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
AC2AZ. Yeah, it sounds interesting. So you're telling me that I don't need my antenna tuner after my linear. That's interesting. I leave it in there, I guess, when I'm not using the linear. The solid-state transceiver still needs it. But I was interested in the sensitivity of the grid tuning. It seems like if I don't tweak it properly and I breathe on the
on the drive from the transmitter. It's a linear. The grid current just goes way off scale, and of course you don't want to do that. They stress it in the manual 10 times over not to exceed 120 mils. So I was just wondering what that sensitivity is between the tune and load and the grid current.
Okay, I'm not completely familiar with your 10-tech high-power amplifier, Bob, but I'm getting the impression that you've got a tuning network on the grid circuit. I'm assuming now it's grid-driven, although it might be cathode-driven, and your plate circuit has this pi-output network, and you're going to get some interaction with those if the power transmitting tube happens to be a triode or happens to be grounded grid cathode-driven. In either of those cases, there's a fair amount of interaction between the output tuning and the input tuning. They do affect each other. And when everything is set up correctly, you don't want the grid current to exceed a certain number, because the grid current, in many cases, represents extra dissipation. You take the voltage that's on the grid and the current that's flowing through it, and you multiply those two together, and that's how much power the control grid is dissipating. And you don't want your control grid to dissipate too much power, otherwise you burn it up, and a very expensive tube goes down the drain. And you're now, I think, asking what's really going on. First of all, the input tuning quite often is very persnickety, very sharp in its tuning characteristics. It's a rather high Q network in many cases, particularly if it's a control grid-driven, grounded cathode service. They can be a very, because the control grid has an awful lot of capacitance, when you finally resonate that, you end up with a very sharp tuning characteristic. Your QSY between the low end and the high end of the band on, say, for instance, 10 meters, you may have to do a significant amount of retuning and loading. And so what you could do in a case like that, if yours doesn't have automatic tuning, let me drop. You could make yourself a tuning chart so that when you're on this frequency, you set each of these dials at these numbers, and when you're on that frequency, you set those dials at those numbers, and you can arrive at the tuning very rapidly by writing those down ahead of time, as opposed to going through the tuning process when you're in the heat of battle of trying to get that DX station. Then it's just QSY'd up the band, you followed him, and you want to be the first guy in that pileup to talk to him, so to speak. So by knowing your tuning and loading control settings ahead of time could be a real advantage. The way a tube works, you've got a certain amount of capacitance between the control grid and the cathode. You've got a certain amount, and that's the input side. You've got a certain amount of capacitance between control grid and the plate circuit. That's the output side. And by the way of input and output tuning and loading and reactance and resonance and whatever, there's all kinds of ways you can set up that electron cloud inside that tube such that grid current is drawn, and you want to avoid those settings that do that. Overdriving is one condition, but improper tuning can also do it. There's a bit of a learning curve to learn all of the characteristics of your particular amplifier. Each one of these afterburners have got their own characteristics that you have to learn. I wonder if that helps a little bit, Bob. Drag your feet in case we have someone else on frequency who owns your 10-tech amplifier and can tell us his experience. AC2AZ with a little bit of delay, K2RIW in the second half.
K-E-Y.
I thought so. Go right ahead, Mel.
I'm not familiar with which 10-tech. I didn't hear it. Maybe I missed it. However, a good way of checking, as you said, get familiar. You can do it without actually putting the rig on the air. You can take a handheld antenna analyzer, connect it to the output, to the transmitter output, and get the characteristics there of what's going on by manipulating the loading, and you say the tuning and loading control, and look at it on the analyzer for that particular band. You're never going to do any damage, Dick. Over.
Now, let me have a couple of more words on this one, Mel. The antenna analyzer, ordinarily you connect that to your transmission line, and let me think now. MFJ, among other people, make some pretty nice ones that people like, and it'll tell you what is the standing wave ratio of your antenna, or what is the resistive component, what is the reactive component. So it'll normally you use it in the forward-looking mode, and it looks at the antenna. I think you're telling me now to take that antenna analyzer
and use it in the reverse mode, so to speak. Look at the output of your transmitter before you do any real transmitting, is what I think you're suggesting. And what I think you're saying is that once you've adjusted those controls correctly before the transmitter is turned on, maybe it's in the standby mode, you've got bias current but no drive signal, and you look into it and you create an impedance match by way of the antenna tuner. Maybe that's what you're suggesting, but I'm not sure. Back to you, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
That's actually a way of testing the high section of the transmitter without applying power. You use the handheld analyzer because the pi section, as you said, is basically condenser followed by a coil followed by another condenser, similar to your tuner. And you basically can get an idea of where it's set at that particular time without going much further. That's the nice part of it before you can always get you into the ballpark. Is your idea, so you don't have to, as you say, take a chance and do any damage, you know, of fiddling around trying to tune this thing through a whole bunch of, you know, different settings. So you'd like to get it as close as possible, you know, without applying actually the power from the rig, Dick, over.
Bob could do his tuning into a dummy load. That would be one way of not creating any interference on the air while he goes through all this tuning procedure. And assuming that his dummy load is close to the same impedance of his antenna, that can work very well. When a linear amplifier has been turned into the active mode, in other words, you put all the B-plus voltage on the plate, you put the bias voltage on the grid, it's got its normal standby current, it's being drawn, but you haven't applied any RF energy to drive it yet. When you look back into that amplifier through its output network, you will see the impedance of the tube, and if it was a pure Class A amplifier, the impedance you measured would be exact. In the case of an amplifier that's biased a little bit closer to a Class B, which means it doesn't draw current throughout the whole RF cycle, then the impedance is a little bit more dynamic. By that I mean when the full RF energy is applied to the amplifier and the plate voltage is swinging through its complete range, the impedance you develop in the tube is a little bit lower than you will measure when you look back with an antenna analyzer on a Class B amplifier. But it gets you very close, gets you into the ballpark. You got to be a little bit careful when you do this, because if somebody turns on your transmitter by mistake, when your antenna analyzer is connected to the output of a kilowatt amplifier, and you start applying those kind of watts into your antenna analyzer, obviously you can do damage in a hurry. So you got to be kind of careful with this one. So it's a way of getting in the ballpark of the tuning. I'd rather use the dummy load, or I'd rather go to a quiet portion of the band, so to speak. You can't do that on a Saturday afternoon when the band is really crowded, but go to a quiet portion of the band and do some tune-up. So these are some of the choices you've got, as I see it, Bob. AC2AZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2IVX with a comment.
Go right ahead, Len.
Dick, I may have misunderstood the question, but it sounded like he was saying do these tests without any applying any voltage to the final amplifier. And I may have misunderstood that, but it sounded like he was not applying any power to the amplifier, or maybe that was another suggestion. I may have misheard it, and if I did, I apologize. But I think the important note is whether you're linear or not, if you don't apply power, you don't see the output impedance of the amplifier, which is terminating the other half of the Pi network, and you're really not seeing the correct issues, conditions for the match, I believe. Dick, over.
I agree with you, Len. The tube presents a real impedance, which is both a capacitor and a resistor, when voltages are applied to the tube under normal operating conditions and it's doing the right amount of standby current. It's a real impedance, but yes, you don't apply RF energy. If the tube was in the thoroughly passive mode, no drive and no no B-plus voltages on the plate, and no bias voltages, then the tube is a pure capacitive open circuit. And although your Pi network still has a resonant frequency, and your antenna tuner will tell you something about are you in the right ballpark for resonance, you're not going to really see the right impedance. So I agree with you, Lynn. And although people have done this, I'm not recommending this a procedure. I wonder if anyone's got any further comments on using an antenna analyzer, looking into the back end of a high-power amplifier in order to find the right tuning. If you've got some opinions on that, give me your call letters right now. K2RAW in the TechNet.
KO2, okay.
KO2, okay. I should know you. Start up your name, sir, and then your comment. K2RAW, my name is Dick.
Evening, Dick. KO2OK. The name is Bennett. Happy New Year. A long-time listener, and once in a while I chime in. I've done the antenna analyzer route, usually when the amplifier is apart, and I can stick a resistor across the couple of tube pins. But otherwise, most modern amplifiers have a relay inside, so it's usually in bypass mode until you key the amplifier or you mechanically bridge the, or switch over that relay. So I don't think you'd be seeing the output Pi network of the amplifier unless it's in the transmit mode. Depends maybe on the amplifier. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, that's good information, Bennett. Once again, the way that relay works, you probably have to key the rig to get the amplifier into the active mode, in which case you've got to do something else to make double darn sure that you've got all of the drive of your transmitter set to near zero so you're not applying a kilowatt of RF energy into your antenna tuner. So Bennett's done it by putting a resistor in substitution for the plate circuit of the tube to act like the tube's load. So I presume the tube is there. The tube is not turned on as far as B plus is concerned, and a resistor is across the tube, so the capacitance of the tube is present, and you simulate the dynamic resistance of the tube that it will have in the active mode by putting a real load resistor at that point. That's one approach for doing it. But I think Bob's going to get more bang for the dollar out of either applying the real power to his antenna, maybe he's got to do it at the 3 o'clock in the morning when the band is empty locally, or into a dummy load is the better way, I think. The antenna tuner approach could be a little bit more elaborate, but know that you've got that capability if you want to do it that way, Bob. AC2AZ, for any other comments, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
What's the final tube that is rigged?
Yeah. So tell us once again, Bob, the 10-tech model number, and if you happen to know what tubes are there, that would help also. You got it, Bob.
I still got to get used to those tones on the repeater. It sounds like I'm in gimbals or something. This is a 10-tech Titan 425. It's a 1.5 kilowatt amplifier. It's just a standard grounded grid amplifier. The tubes are 3CX800, a pair of them, and there's no tuning on the input. There's a switchable tuning network that's switched by band, but once you're in band, there's no further tuning. The only tuning there is, as you mentioned, Dick, C1 and C2 on the output. Let me tell you what I do without an antenna tuner. I've got a regular kilowatt antenna tuner, and normally I'm using that anyway with the transceiver, so I'm already tuned on the band, and so when I key up the linear, it's looking into 50 ohms already, or close to it. Unless you have some superb antenna, you're going to need a tuner for most multi-band antennas anyway. So on one antenna's position on the tuner, I've got a dummy load. So what I do is I'm on the band, I tune up the transceiver into the tuner, and then when I'm ready, I flip it over to the dummy load, tune up the linear amplifier, and now the linear is ready to go on the band, with its own tune and load set, and with the antenna tuner already tuned up for it. So I'm not worried about blowing up the amplifier going into the antenna. My concern mostly was watching that grid meter just sometimes take off when you're when you're off the other side. They're telling you to look and peak up the power. Well, this linear has either power or grid. You can't do both. So I have my eyes someplace else looking at the peak power, and you try to split your vision between the grid meter and the peak power meter somewhat removed, and I find that a little tricky. So I was just curious what the tune and load interaction was with the grid and why that grid takes off sometimes. Back to you, Dick, AC28.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Quite well, Dick.
Yeah, I'm going to turn it over to Mel in a minute. The 3CX800A5, I think it is beautiful. Forced air-cooled external anode ceramic tubes. Very nice tubes made by iMac, among other people. And I think Svetlana probably has an equivalent to that tube. I'm guessing that your tube is being run in grounded grid service. You're driving the cathode with something like 50 watts for full power output, I'm guessing, in that ballpark. And you have to be double darn sure that when you apply the 50 watts of drive to the cathode, that what's happening is that tremendous numbers of electrons are boiling off of that cathode with the positive half, correction, the negative halves of your RF cycle that you're driving the cathode with. And if the B plus of the plate is properly loaded, those electrons, as they go flying from the cathode through the control grid toward the plate, if that instant of time, the plate is more positive by a long shot than the cathode, the electrons go flying through the grid, they hit the plate, and everything's hunky-dory. If by mistake you adjust the tuning and loading controls, let me drop. If you adjust the tuning and loading controls on that Pi network so that the plate is being lightly loaded, that means the voltage swing on the plate becomes much bigger. If at the instant of time that the cloud of electrons is leaving that cathode and they're flying through the control grid, and if that instant of time, because the plate circuit has got a great big RF voltage swing, and therefore at that instant the plate is running at a very low positive voltage or even a negative voltage, those electrons no longer say, hey, that plate is more positive, I feel attracted to them. They say, I'm going to go stick to the grid instead. And therefore you start getting very high grid current. So you got to worry about being in resonance but lightly loaded. That makes a great big voltage swing. It creates this condition where the instantaneous voltage is too low, the control grids will stick to the control, the electrons will stick to the control grid instead of flying through to the plate, and you get this high grid current. So you got to worry about that. You also have to worry about if anything goes wrong, so that a fuse is blown and the high voltage on the plate of the tube is absent at the time that you're applying drive to the cathode. Now, by definition, that plate is not more positive. All of those electrons will stick to the grid. You'll get extremely high grid current, and you can burn up that grid in a very small number of seconds. So you've got to worry about that a little bit. I'd like to believe the amplifier has got some kind of a protect circuit, which if the B-plus is not on the plate, it won't allow you to apply drive. The relays are not thrown or whatever. I'd like to believe it has that, because if you had to replace those two tubes because you burned them up by burning up those control grids, dollar-wise, you'd be a little bit unhappy. K2KEY, K2RIW, tell us more about this, those tubes, Mel. You got it, Mel.
Real quick.
Go ahead, Bob.
Did I drop out before? Went to the repeater timeout on me?
You timed out within 1 second. We didn't lose a word, not to worry. You got it, Mel.
Okay, I dug up some facts. I have here the original instructions. What happened years ago with the 3CX800s when iMac introduced them, they had a deal that if you buy one with the socket, the chimney, they would give you the second one if you were ham for a half price. That was to encourage hams to build amplifiers with them. In fact, I guess I built one of the original amplifiers using that those tubes. And in fact, that later on, somebody did come along, looked at the amplifier, got very impressed, and went into the business of manufacturing them commercially. However, in the original instructions here, iMac, it said initial work after the amplifier is completed should be done with a grid dip meter. particularly on the output circuit with the tubes in place, but no voltages should be applied. The shorting block on the end of the plate line should be set to give a paddle tuning range that straddles the desired operating frequency. So, and they go on and on and on here, and then they tell you, of course, about having, make sure that you have the adequate, what they call, grid strip, as you said. And they warn you, word of caution, remember, that the heater voltage must be applied for at least 3 minutes, and at least 3 minutes before, never exceed 50 mil DC grid current, even during warm-up, et cetera, et cetera. I bought four of these tubes from IMAC, got two amplifiers I put together, and they work terrific if you do the right thing, and you got to remember, let me let it drop one more thing. Central part of the circuit is the tuned input, which consists of a series capacitor, an inductor, and another capacitor. That's the input circuit. Checking that initially. That's why I say you check a lot of these things with the day you were using grids if needed. Like I say, today you can use a handheld antenna analyzer. But it was very important to determine a number of these things as IMAC cautioned you. That's where I came up with this procedure, Dick. Over.
I'm going to be turning it over to Bob in a minute. By the way, all of those tones, Bob, are to make sure that the machine does properly reset. We were always, for the last few weeks, piling on top of each other, not allowing the machine to properly reset, and the people in the hinterlands that are listening to the TechNet by way of IRLP or Echolink or whatever were being chopped out by things being timed out. So what Eric has done was to add these four tones. By the time you listen to all four tones, you've done the right amount of delay time. I should also tell you that in the case of a Pi network, the loading control, as you make that capacitor go to larger amounts of picofarads, in other words, the plates more meshed, that is the direction of lighter loading, opposite of common sense, lighter loading, and you got to be careful about not going too far in that direction, because if the amplifier is resonated with light loading, you can run into this high control grid current condition, as I described earlier. So in other words, tend to move in the direction of the loading control C2 capacitor in smaller amounts of picofarads. Less meshing of that capacitor gives you heavier loading, and the heavier loading is safer for the tube until you really become familiar with taking the amplifier for absolute maximum power output. And hopefully there is a control grid bias protection circuit that when it sees more than 50 milliamperes of grid current per tube, either flashes a red light or turns the amplifier or does something to protect those tubes, because the dollars of those tubes are such that you'd be a little unhappy if you had to replace them. AC2AZ, K2RIW. Go ahead, Bob.
Yeah, that was my big concern. I'm looking at the schematics. It does have an ALC. I've got to follow it through to see what it's doing. But this thing did peak at, you know, for a tiny, tiny fraction of a second, it did peak past 120 mils. And Mel, according to my manual here, it says 120 milliamps for a pair of 3CX800. So that's what they're holding to over here. The manual's got a very good tune-up procedure. It, you know, it's just a matter of keep an eye on that grid current. They tell you to bring up the plate slowly, watch the grid, and then tune from there and bring up the power as a little bit at a time. So they've got a good procedure there. But I was just curious what that interaction was. So, yeah, I definitely have to dive into this. It's got an ALC output. I was wondering if I could drive it into my transmitter here. And the manual says that's only used for tube transceivers, not solid-state ones. So that's kind of disappointing. But I definitely need to look into this. I do have a license to overdrive, but again, if you have your eyes on one meter, on a power meter, and not on the grid meter, you can lose it for a fraction of a second there. So back to you guys, AC2AC.
Those 3CX800 tubes are fairly rugged, Bob. There's a bit of conservativeness in those ratings. By that I mean you're worried that you've exceeded 120 milliamps. You did it for a fraction of a second. The real thermal time constant of that grid, I'm not sure of the exact number, but if someone told me it's 3 or 4 seconds, I'd believe it. So, would they really burn up at 120 mils? I doubt it.